Well, we're here at the 18th annual ASD Symposium on Roads on the Patuxent in Rhode Island, and it's really my honor to have today's guest speaker all day long, fresh back from her presentation, Paula Kluth. Thank you so much for coming down and talking to me after a very energetic day that you've had.
It's my pleasure. This is my second time actually at this symposium and my first time being interviewed. So I'm really honored to be able to share even a few more thoughts with this audience who's always so energetic and gracious and hungry for information. So thank you for having me.
And my first question is if you can just give us a little Reader's Digest look at your background.
Sure. I am a former professor of education and am now doing mostly teacher education, working with school districts in my hometown area of Chicago, but also around the country. And I do some research still, even though I'm not in a university context anymore, and work mostly on issues of inclusive schooling, differentiating instruction, and just really developing more responsive lessons for kids, not only kids with autism labels, but for any child, you know, helping schools to become places that are very welcoming for all kids and enjoyable for all kids.
And we've had the pleasure of being a part of the presentation, and which is also the title of your book, Joyful Learning, and I wonder if you can talk about that a little.
Sure. Well, I can't talk about the book without mentioning my wonderful co-author who isn't here today. Her name's Alice Udvari-Solmer. And it's Alice's life work, even more than mine, to look at lesson design, the architecture, the infrastructure of lessons, and sort of try to add greater variety to lessons in our classrooms as a way of not only making instruction more accessible for kids with and without disabilities, but also to make schools more pleasurable, to make schools feel safer for a lot of kids. Alice and I put this book out, Joyful Learning, as a way to say that, you know, even if you're teaching material that's very dry, and quite frankly, especially if you're teaching material that's quite dry or challenging for students, if we can teach it in a way that is spirited, if we can teach it in a way that feels less risky to kids, we may not only reach those learners and help them succeed, but we might also change their attitudes about schooling.
And the approach you use is called active learning. Why is that so important?
Well, we talk about in the book active and collaborative learning. And so by active learning, we sort of define that by structures that where kids might have agency, control, empowerment, where they may get to do something. That might mean physical movement, that might mean just interaction or conversation. It could mean physically responding to somebody or acting something out. Like I was just in a classroom where we were acting out a food web, or in another classroom where we were showing the difference, physically showing the difference between fusion and fission, for instance, acting out the parts of a story. With collaborative learning, we're talking about teaching kids the skills and helping them to practice skills of being in groups. So some of the exercises are simply about having kids share together with one person, and some of them are teaching skills about how to just collaborate, you know, with a larger group, whether it's just in discussion or it's in the creation of products or shared ideas.
So the whole collaborative and active learning are kind of interchangeable?
They are. I don't think everybody uses them in that way, but that's sort of how we have defined it, that there's it's sort of a Venn diagram. So some activities that we use a lot are just active, and some of them are more collaborative, but not terribly active. And some of them sort of share a space in between where there's a lot of collaboration and sort of a lot of activity as well. And I think there's a place for a lot of these activities in most classrooms, although I think we would both say not all activities are for all classrooms and not all activities are for all students.
So how is this collaborative and active learning useful for people with autism?
Well, the reason that, you know, this work is often of interest to teachers who support kids on the spectrum is because they're, I think, continuously looking for ways to engage students and looking for ways for, I guess, curricular responses to things like perceived low motivation or behavior challenges and things like that, or, you know, helping kids to grow communication and social skills. I see a lot of teachers who are very open to, you know, a lot of the same old techniques aren't working. You know, I mean, we've tried these same kinds of activities or we've used these kind of social groups for a while. What else is there? And when we introduce them to some of these ideas where they can use activities that will help kids actually learn standards-based content, help them learn multiplication tables, help them learn about the carbon cycle, something we talked about today, help them learn about the American Revolution. And at the same time, they can practice social skills. And quite frankly, we really see that students' behavior changes. You know, I always say that if you really want to look at behavior and supporting that, you have to look at how satisfying is your day. And this is not just for kids with disabilities, but how fun, interesting, motivating, relevant, meaningful, appropriately challenging is your day. And that kind of recommendation holds for kids with autism, for kids with emotional needs, for kids who are seen as at risk. If we just look at curriculum and what we're allowing them to do or asking them to do, oftentimes, you know, I see for kids with autism, even if we don't know right away if they understand every bit of the content, when we can see that we can practice those social skills and communication skills, we're getting at all of the other elements that seem important to us. It's sort of, you know, a least dangerous assumption. Why not also add on the potential practice and development of skills that their general ed peers are learning? So to me, it's like a, I don't know, it's like all in one. It's just the perfect package.
You sort of answered the question about can these strategies be used in the classroom, but I was curious, are there classrooms where, like, there might be some classrooms that are good? What would be maybe an example of a classroom where it may not work?
Well, I think you can always use active and collaborative learning, but some particular strategies don't work as well, say, for smaller groups of kids. So some of the structures work better for larger groups and more interaction. Some of the activities actually, you know, the spaces themselves, you know, don't work well. I'll never forget being in Chicago public schools years ago, and we were trying to play a game where kids got into small clusters, and the teachers told me, we can't play the game in that way because all the desks are nailed down to the floor. So that's a pretty rare example. But, you know, a lot of teachers will say that because their classroom is self-contained or they only have kids who don't speak, for example. I think it is hard to play some of these games and activities in those contexts, but a sort of a simple way to address those concerns is these may be perfect opportunities to bring general education peers and special education peers together to play some of these games and introduce some of these activities. Sort of instead of just having folks do peer tutoring in a more traditional way, let's bring kids together where we can sort of all learn with some shared objectives and that we have models for speech and communication, for example, and we have folks that have social skills that we need. And so we can sort of bring those together into these activities so that we have the not only the materials that we need for the activities, but we have the personal support that we need. Because I do think if you have three students, a lot of these are challenging to pull off if you don't have a lot of energy and a lot of opportunities to interact with several different folks.
We concentrated today on classrooms, how some of these activities can be used in the classroom settings. Can these be used by parents?
Yeah, there are several that can be used by parents. And the same ones that are good for parents are the same ones that are nice for the smaller class sizes. For example, there's one technique that we didn't actually use in the workshop called Say Something. It's not our technique. It's actually a National Reading Panel endorsed. It's from Harst and colleagues. And it's simply the idea of sitting down with your child and doing some, you can do it with shared independent reading, where each person reads to themselves, or the parent can read to the child a page or a paragraph at a time, and you simply stop at the end of each page or paragraph, turn to each other, and say something. The name of it is Say Something. And you don't have to make a specific point. You don't answer a comprehension question. You just sort of talk about something that you remember, something that's notable to you. This helps a lot of our kids on the spectrum who, if you read to the end of the book or the passage, they've already forgotten the first paragraph. So it's a way to sort of give them those opportunities to pause, digest, and then move on. I teach that to a lot of parents. It's good for speech therapists to use, and it's also nice in those smaller classrooms.
In addition to your presentation today and your book, you have a documentary that I noticed. I wonder if you want to talk a bit about the documentary film that you directed.
Sure, always. it's called We Thought You'd Never Ask, which I loved the title and got committed to the title before I even made the movie. Sort of a humorous title, which refers to the fact that we've been talking about autism for so many years now, and 50 years, and it's only been so recently that we've talked to people with autism about autism. So I used to go on the road just like everybody else, and I would talk about this colleague, this friend, this student, and I'd be like the ambassador of autism, like many of us are. And I'm sharing these stories, and I thought, boy, I wish that my friend Barbara, who actually this story belongs to, I wish she was here telling the story. And sometimes I would be presenting with Barbara, but more often not. So I decided to go out and make a movie with these six colleagues who I'd known for years and just say, like, if I would love for you all to answer these questions for everybody. So in the film, I ask everybody, what is autism? What's hard about autism? What's good about autism? You know, and really from these experts, let them tell the story. And that the film, I mean, to me, it's, I'm not in the film at all. I'm just sort of behind the scenes, but that's where I hate to say, but people really start to believe some of the things I've been saying. It's like, wow, is it that hard to make eye contact? Wow, does sensory overload feel that horrible? And it just touches people. And, you know, here are these grown adults who have done a lot of presenting and have been on, you know, this side of it. They can now give a voice for the younger children, you know, out there who aren't speaking for themselves at this point.
How can people get a hold of that if they wanted to?
It's actually distributed through a site called, a group called Landlocked Films. It's in Colorado, hence the name Landlocked. Landlocked Films, and again, the title is We Thought You'd Never Ask. If you go to YouTube, if you're not on Landlocked or you forget the name, but you go to YouTube and you type in Thought You'd Never Ask, you can see a clip of the film on YouTube, and there's also a link to take you over to Landlocked Films. People can always contact me, too, if they forget and they can't find it. But it's inexpensive. All of the money, it all goes through a nonprofit, so it goes to a good cause, and, you know, really, really compelling stuff.
I also want to commend you in closing this interview. I did go on the website last night, and I looked at a couple of your articles. My favorite one is Take Off That Blindfold.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
I liked it because that happens to be my view of disability. Maybe you can briefly describe so that, you know, what people know what we're talking about. If you can briefly describe that article.
Well, Dennis, since I would like to use this interview too, would you mind making a few comments about it? Because people have a hard time understanding what's so horrible. What Dennis and I are talking about is when disability awareness is done in this sort of, you know, superficial way where this is what it's like to be in a wheelchair, and we put kids in a wheelchair for the day, a wheelchair that would be nothing like one that a user would probably have and access. We say, hey, here's what it's like to be deaf, and we put, you know, headphones on, and here's what it's like to be blind, and we blindfold somebody. And what most kids find is that when you blindfold them, they can't find anything, they have no skills, it seems terrifying, and they think, well, that would be the worst thing. That's not what we're really after in disability awareness.
It's actually an exaggerated thing, because, and also you can get out of the wheelchair afterwards, and you can take the blindfolds off, and you can take the tape out of your ears.
Right.
So it doesn't really simulate the disability.
That's right.
And that's just a personal opinion of the interviewer.
Exactly. Well, and I'm so glad that you're saying it, that we're both chiming in, you know. But I appreciate that so much, and I've gotten the most reaction from that one. What we say in the piece, Dennis, is that it's more helpful, not that it's not important to learn about, first of all, if you're going to learn about those needs, learn about it from people who experience them, who have expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So not from somebody who's saying, this is what I think it's like. Number two is that it's as important, if not more important, to use disability awareness time activities or whatever to focus on inequity and bias and things like that. So what we're saying is, you know, have students go through their school and look around at how they might adapt something and change it where there's inequity, bias, or, you know, any kind of inequality. Like if you don't have any kids accessing extracurricular activities who have sensory needs, how will you students fix this, adapt this, tackle this? If you notice that there's certain kids in your school who can't, you know, there was one school I worked in where certain kids couldn't go on the field trip because it was inaccessible physically. And I said to the kids, are you okay with this? And they said, no. So, okay, well, I don't want to say protest, but that's essentially saying, why do you protest? You know, like, we have to make these kids aware. And when we do, even the slightest nudge in the direction of helping students learn that civil rights and human rights lesson, you know, they become unstoppable. They see things you would never see. You would never notice some of these other inequalities, and they begin to see it.
You have an article also about accessible transportation,
yeah.
People coming in on segregated, that's my words, not your words, segregated buses rather than coming on board, being able to ride with children without disabilities each day as well. So you actually cover, you know, advocates probably running on school board positions as well. So these are, I would recommend people to go on paulakluth.com and take a look at those articles.
Thank you, Dennis. And I loved your input on those items too.
And I just want to remind everybody that A Presence on Your Journey is a podcast of community autism resources. Our executive director is Barbara Domain. We were ably assisted today. Technical assistance was provided by Kate Danzero. Nicholas Domain is the editor. And you can also go to our website if you want to hear this and other podcasts, www.community-autism-resources.com, or you can access it on iTunes. And the music for the intro and the outro is written by George Winston. And my name is Dennis Polselli. And thank you for listening.